Hello and welcome to episode 78 of Podaroni. Yeah. So this episode is an interview with Peter Sheridan, the director. And this intro has been done for your benefit in a park in Kansas City, where I've been performing at the Kansas City Irish Festival for the last two days before yesterday. I was there, I was performing on Friday, Saturday and Sunday. Pretty busy because I was doing the stand-up two nights. I was doing an improv workshop 3 days and I was doing a kids show two of the days, so it was non-stop. And then yesterday I went out and shot a promo for a feature film that I will be shooting here in Kansas City next year. So doing lots of stuff here in Kansas City. And tonight I'm teaching another improv workshop, and on Friday I'm guesting with a musical improv group. I'm really looking forward to that because I love improv and I love music. Oh yeah. And I did a gig in Chicago, but you know, that's it. That was my life for the last while. And it's pretty windy here. Can you hear that wind blowing? But it's warm. And I've been going around on bicycles in both Chicago and Kansas City. I hired those like Dublin bikes, but city bikes. And every time I hire one and I tell somebody, oh, I'm gonna meet you, I'll cycle there, I've just hired a bike, they reply with the two-word answer, be careful. And I suppose I can understand that, because in America, the car is king. And you know, when you press the button to cross the road, it always feels like you're an imposition, really, because the man to walk comes on. It's a man, isn't it? But pretty quickly it turns into a flashing hand and tells you how little time you have left to cross the massive road, and the cars are huge as well. And if you go down to Chicago waterfront, that road, there's a road that goes right along the waterfront, and they flipping fly down there. But I cycled down there around, like, from where I was staying, which was a lovely kind of Mexican area with that has been gentrified, I'd say, with a few trendy things moving in there. And cycled all the way down to the waterfront. Nearly got flattened, because obviously the bicycle path is also the you cycle on the right. So I was cycling on the left, and a load of people on bicycles came flying, hurtling towards me. But I got out of the way quick enough. And around here in Kansas City, it's less cycly, I must say. There is a runny path. I went for a run this morning, and I was running for about 5 minutes, and then my flipping right calf seized up, and it's so annoying because I was looking forward to a run, because I'm staying right beside a running path. I was so looking forward to the run, and that's gone now. And I think the reason is because I banjaxed my knee doing a forward roll for a kids gig 2 days or 3 days before I left for America, to a bunch of kids who were quite, you know, they weren't really even into the, you know, there was only 12 of them there in a garden in Kilruddery at 11 o'clock on a Saturday morning. And because possibly there were so few people there and the atmosphere wasn't as good as a big kiddie show, I did too much. I did a forward roll and I landed on my knee. I have a dodgy right knee anyway, and banjaxed that. And so I couldn't go for a run for a few days, and I cycled for a few days. And I did a lot of walking around Chicago and cycled as well. But I wanted to go for a run, and you know, it's just frustrating. I just see these people running now, and I want to kick them and injure them really badly so that they can't run as well. That's how I feel about it. It's, yeah. And so I'm sitting around the park. There's lots of fountains in Kansas City. There's one just over there with the horses. not live ones, statues of horses. But such a modern looking place, though. It is. There's a very old looking fountain. And there's the fountains near the centre where the Kansas City Irish Festival was going on, where it had green water. Yeah. It's just cool, you know. I went to see the Academic play, and they were really good. And they were nice lads. And one of them actually came up during the night looking for my advice on something that he was either going to do or not going to do. He was waiting on my advice. So like, I feel like an elder statesman of show business now, when young lads in bands will come up and ask for your advice. Isn't that nice? I go, yeah, in my opinion. And I don't think he took my advice, but it was nice that he asked. So that was it. I mean, a lot of the bands at the festival are trad, but they do have, Kansas City in particular, do try to book a rock band or an indie band. And so they booked the Academic. The Hot Sprockets were on 4 years ago, I remember, and the Academic were the new up-and-coming band this year. So that's it. I'm going to teach another improv group tonight, and I'm going to just knock around Kansas City. I'm going to write a few things, and I'll put this in this podcast out, and soak up a bit of sun, because I suppose when I go back to Ireland, the sun, what there was of it, will definitely be gone. So I'm going to try and make a bit of headway into just getting a little bit of colour on my arms, and I'm not lying in the sun. I'm just going to walk around with shorts on. But that's it. So this is Peter Sheridan, and very interesting story about how he got into theatre and his father. And, well, you know, you'll hear it as you listen. That's generally the idea, isn't it? So enjoy it. It's Peter Sheridan. Peter, thanks for meeting up. And I mean, I haven't mentioned that much, but I just happened to meet you in the house there when I was Denny Bonet was staying, and her friend, what was her friend?
Don Piper,
who you know.
Yeah.
He's a friend of yours, is it? Yeah.
No, from Austin, Texas.
Yeah.
Where I've spent a bit of time.
Have you?
Mm. Right. There's a guy down in Texas, his name is Don Toner. And he runs a theatre down there. But I met him first in LA in the mid-80s. I went over to Los Angeles in 85 mm-hmm. to do a production of a play I'd written about the hunger strikes called Diary of a Hunger Strike. Mm-hmm. And he was one of the producers in this theatre in LA. They'd poured millions into it. They were trying to rejuvenate the inner city of LA. They were bringing a lot of people in from abroad, international people. And I was one of the people they brought over from Ireland to do this play. And he was my producer, my right-hand guy. And within a day of meeting him, I knew he'd be a friend of mine for the rest of my life. He was just one of those kind of guys. He was very paternalistic, very much a father figure, old enough to be my father. And we just bonded, and I got on just swimmingly well with him.
Yeah.
And within a couple of days, he had stories about me he used to tell all the people. And he used to go into the theatre and say, he said, now Peter, he said, has a bar called Monty's that he goes into up on 7th Avenue in LA. Nobody in their right mind would go into this place.
Oh, yeah.
It was worse than a bombed out bar in Andersonstown.
Yeah.
It was like no windows in the front. I was the only white guy ranking it.
Yeah.
It was all blacks and Central Americans and crazy people. But they adopted me as the token Irishman, the token white guy.
Cool.
And the guy who ran the bar, Cuban Mike, this guy ran the bar, he was a cocaine dealer.
Yeah.
So from the day I arrived there, I had free cocaine.
Yeah.
And I developed a very, very nice habit.
Did you?
Over the period of 3 months, yeah.
Did you? Yeah,
yeah, I was on coke every single day.
Jenny, man.
Yeah, this guy used to give me coke, and I was just like, wow, I love this drug. Love it. It was kind of, I was at the end of my drugging, 85, 86.
Right, and I didn't know you had a drug period.
Oh, God, yeah. I stopped drinking in 89.
Yeah.
But I stopped taking dope in 82. It was really beginning to affect me very badly.
Mm.
So I stopped dope in 82, and then I continued on with other substances, but that 3 month period I was in LA on cocaine, really, when I came home to Ireland, I was in a really bad place. The hangover from not having my cocaine anymore, you know.
Right, yeah.
It was really not a nice place to be in your head. It was like a mental hangover. It was dreadful.
Oh, yeah.
But I did a show while I was down there, and I was drinking and drugging and doing all that mad stuff. But I was coming to the end of it, but Don minded me. This guy, Don Toner, minded me while I was down there. And he was fantastic to me. Kept me. I could have kind of tipped over. It was the nearest I ever came to blowing a job completely, professionally.
Yeah.
I really nearly didn't get the show on. I was in such a bad way. And I had an amazing cast. I had Colin Meaney playing the lead. I had a guy called Sean Cassidy, who was a pop star, brother of David Cassidy.
Oh, really? Yeah. Sean Cassidy.
Yeah, Sean. Yeah, his brother, yeah. David's younger brother.
Yeah, yeah.
Great guy. Another great
right,
guy.
Yeah.
Top line cast I had on the show, and the show went really well. Right. And a lot of the movie people were asking me to write movie scripts.
Yeah, yeah.
They were asking me to write film scripts for them.
Yeah.
On the basis of having seen the play, they were, you know, they didn't get the play.
Yeah.
They got me, and they thought, "Well, you're a really interesting writer. What you've written here is great. And do you think you could write movies?" And it was before Jim had made My Left Foot, and you know, I was interested a little bit in film, and Jim was very interested in film. And he actually came out from New York at that time to see the play, and we met loads of people. We met amazing people in Los Angeles, and I came back to Ireland intent on bringing the family out. I came home really to bring the kids and Sheila out to LA. And when I came back, while I was in Los Angeles, this is how you like the drug fuel thing, I was writing like a mad thing while I was on this cocaine. And I wrote a show called Mother of All the Beans. And I came back with this script and I gave it to Ray Yates, who was involved in the Abbey Theatre at the time. And within a week, he said, "I want to do this show in the Peacock." Opening in, ba-boom. And I said, "Oh, yeah, great." And he said, "I want you to direct it." So suddenly I had a gig in the Abbey. So I postponed coming out to LA. And just kind of my career, in a way, kind of took off a bit in 87. In the theatre, I suddenly got a lot of jobs.
So, but you're saying that the cocaine didn't damage your creativity then? You were actually creating...
No, it didn't. But it damaged my ability to pull the show together that I was working on out there. It hit me more that way than it did. Because I just felt... I've always been a workaholic. I've always just worked... I always have been mad about writing and working and being involved. So I'm never not doing anything. I've never been not doing anything in my life, ever.
Right.
So, like, I finished a show on Saturday night. I was working on Sunday on something else. I don't take time off in that way. I'm very much into the work, reading, developing stuff. When I got sober, I became even better at doing all that. But I got the job in the Abbey when I came back from LA, and I never went back. I mean, I was going to move in with Colin Meaney and his wife over there. They had a couple of rooms set up for me and Sheila and the kids to go over, and it just never happened. And the funny thing is that when I came back to Ireland, he got the job on Star Trek.
Right.
Just from the show that he had done with me, he got seen in that, and he got cast in Star Trek, and his career took off. And now I stayed in Dublin and I did Mother of All the Beans, which became a big, big success story in 87, 88. And then I suddenly got a good few jobs that were really interesting. I worked for a company in Belfast called Charabank on Summer Over the Balcony.
Yeah, but you're coming back finding it hard at the same time in your head. At the same time, you're getting this big job.
I was in trouble with the drugs and the alcohol, big time. But I was working like a mad thing, as I always did. And I knew I needed to stop. I knew I needed to stop. I did something really interesting. As I got on the plane coming from Los Angeles, I decided to stop smoking. Now, I was an absolutely inveterate smoker.
Yeah.
I smoked 20, 30 cigarettes every day. Major, really strong cigarettes. And getting on the plane, I thought, you know, my family home in Dublin has been smoke-free for the 3 months I've been in Los Angeles doing this show. And I thought it was really unfair to go back and start smoking again in the house with the kids and Sheila. Sheila's never smoked. And I thought, I'm going to give this a go. And because I was in trouble with the drink, I thought it would be a deflection. If I stopped smoking, I would take attention away from my drugging and drinking. So when I got back, Sheila couldn't believe that I'd stopped smoking. And she had booked a holiday in a place called Trebolgan for herself, the four kids and me. And we went to Trebolgan and I ended up banging my head off the walls for 2 days.
Trying to stop smoking?
Yeah. Absolutely nearly went out of my mind trying to stop smoking.
But you did it.
I'm a determined guy.
Yeah.
When I set my mind to something, hard to shake me off that course. And I just stuck with it and gave them up. And I've never smoked since. I stopped smoking on the 12th of April, 1986.
Just stopped, and that's it. But did your grandfather not die of lung cancer?
Yeah.
And
I remember him dying really well, funnily enough. I remember the cigarettes that he smoked, and I can see him with the long ash on the cigarette. He had that great ability to be down here in the back of his throat somewhere. And Jack McGowan doing that Sucking Stones. It's just mesmeric.
Right, yeah.
It's completely mesmeric.
It's bizarre that I haven't delved into Beckett. Yeah. I think I've read that book, that novel. But there is something about Beckett that puts people off. And I think it's maybe the way it's been interpreted by a certain arty type of person that makes you think Beckett is really bleak. And I'm just listening to you now, and it's not.
Yeah, he's not bleak. Yeah. And his life was just... completely not bleak. I mean, one of the novels of the year last year was a book called A Country Road, A Tree, which is the description he has for Waiting for Godot on the first page. Scene,
right.
A country road, a tree. And then the play starts. But a girl wrote a book about Beckett's activities during the Second World War. So he fought for the French Resistance.
He
was heavily involved in the Resistance. And he ended up having to get out of Paris. They were after him. The Gestapo were after him. So he got out of Paris and he headed for the south of France. And he worked down there for the resistance for 2 years. He was like actively involved in the war. Like, I mean, he was an amazing guy.
Yeah.
And people loved him. People absolutely loved him. And the book is just this girl writing, you know, from what she knows of what Beckett did and then creating a fiction around it, creating a novel. Around it. It's absolutely fascinating stuff.
Right, cool.
Brilliant stuff. And you just get such a sense of this guy, of this man, you know, and what he was about and who he was. And you know, a great, great character.
So did you feel that you had to kind of be an alternative or fight against the establishment in as far as theatre is concerned? That you were out there trying to make theatre for ordinary people or bring people into theatre?
Yeah, I mean, like, I think there's always been that tradition, though.
Yeah.
You know, in many ways, that is what the theatre is. It provides a platform.
But what year are we talking about when you started?
Well, I got involved in 68.
68,
yeah,
right.
I was 16.
Okay.
Yeah, my brother had died in 1967. Frankie, my young brother Frankie, died when he was 10.
And that was
the turning point in our family's history, really.
Really,
yeah, in 67. And it just had a huge impact on everybody, particularly my parents, and particularly my father, who kind of took to the bed, stopped going to work.
Did he get migraines, was it?
Migraines, yeah. And the mother used to go with face cloths and put them on his head. She held the family together.
And this is because your brother died of a brain
tumor. Yeah.
I suppose that I think you said that he might have banged his head.
Yeah. Well, we all had stories about him banging his head.
Yeah.
Okay. After he died, everybody was like, I was with him one day when he,
so it could.
But we all had that story.
Yeah.
It's kind of like that explained it. And somehow, and so we all had a guilt. There was a certain guilt around it. You know, so everybody had their own reason or some story or some scale that they had that related to
it. It's a reason, but it
also
might lead to guilt on everyone's part, I suppose.
Totally. But when the dad went to bed and didn't get up, because he was such a man who never missed work. Like, I mean, he was one of those typical Dublin guys who went to work every day, never missed work. And then he stopped going to work and had all these migraine headaches, and the ma held the family together. And then, as I write, in More Than 47 Roses, he just got up out of the bed and came down and said to the ma, I'm going to be an actor.
Right.
He said, you're not going back to work, Dad? No. I'm going to become an actor.
That's amazing.
And he became an actor.
Mm.
And for 4 years after that, he was the leading light of our drama group, the St. Lawrence O'Toole's Players. And we did shows and we travelled them around Ireland. We did an amateur drama circuit. But very quickly, Jim and myself were off experimenting. Like, we were, we went from the Sean O'Casey plays to street theatre, to revolutionary theatre, to political theatre in the 70s, doing stuff about the North, involved with the official IRA, you know, involved with official Sinn Féin, trying to do stuff that really mattered, stuff about what was going on in the North of Ireland. Jim wrote a play called Carrack. The three characters in it were Carrack, Ter, and Less. Put them together, characterless. So we were kind of bolshy, young fellas, you know, trying to make a mark, you know.
Right.
And, you know, we would travel up to Belfast and do stuff. Yeah. You know, we did stuff all over Ireland. We did stuff in England when we were over in a pea factory in England, earning a few bob one summer, and we did street theatre in the centre of Peterborough on Saturday afternoons about the politics of Ireland and England.
What kind of street theatre are you talking about?
We would do kind of guerrilla stuff, you know.
Yeah.
There would be stuff about the British Army shooting people in Belfast and
the
right of the Irish people to own their own destiny. And we were very politically motivated because my ma, you see, was an out-and-out Provo, you know.
Right.
You know, and she kept refugees from the North in the house.
We had
refugees from Northern, from Belfast, living in the house with us. So the Northern thing was a constant source of grievance and argument in our house.
Right.
My ma was to the left of Gerry Adams, and my dad was much, much less Republican than her. Mm-hmm. And she used to fight with him all the time over the North, and the fact that him and Fianna Fáil were doing nothing about it. And she was up in Haughey's constituency office several times, because he was our local TD, banging the table and banging the door, saying, what are you doing about the North? I mean, she was a goer, my ma.
Wow.
Oh, she was a total goer.
And like, your grandfather was involved in the rising?
Yeah, very much so.
And your grandfather, is this true that your grandfather confessed to you thinking you were a priest? That's in the book.
Yeah.
That is true?
Totally true.
On his deathbed?
Yeah.
He confessed to you?
He confessed that they had trials out in the see, he had a farm at the back of the house in Smithfield.
All right, yeah.
Yeah, he had a horse, Nelly.
Mm.
He had a cow. He had pigs,
chickens.
So there was this big kind of barn, like farm thing. And of course, he went out. His job was, he was a man who went around on a horse and cart moving stuff for people. He would deliver vegetables to the vegetable shops. He was always out and about. I used to go around with him on the horse and cart. I loved it going all around Smithfield. And then stopping, I used to love the horses drinking out of the troughs at the corner of Smithfield, the old granite troughs. And that was the grandfather. But he started hallucinating in his dying years about the trials that they had for informers, which were held in the back of the house in this barn out the back. And they'd find men guilty, and he was imagining them being shot and all sorts of stuff. This was all going on. And then when he died, they dug up the back garden and found loads of guns. After he died. So this was all,
anyway,
like,
this is all
having
your
a very
family history.
Colourful childhood. As you can imagine, this had a huge impact on me as a kid.
Right,
know, and I mean, the first place I headed to after I left school was Belfast. I wanted to see Belfast up close and personal, in the flesh. I wanted to go there.
During the Troubles?
Set in 1970. My mother spoke so much about the North. She hated the Unionist thing. Like, she was, you know, because she had done a lot of her growing up in Belfast in the 30s. She was she was living with a sister of hers, an older sister of hers.
Because
her mother had
been treated like
shit. And it's a bit like Beckett been saying, how can you talk about the Second World War? How can you talk about the fact that we abandoned these people?
Yeah.
We abandoned them up there. They were left to their own devices. These fuckers could go around, you know, giving houses to people with no kids against Catholics. I mean, it was an absolute human disgrace what was going on up there. Absolutely indefensible on any level. No wonder the provost came up out of it. I mean, no wonder there was some sort of a response to what was going on. I'm not saying that the violence was right, but I'm saying it was totally understandable.
But it started off as civil rights.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it was just like, you know, it was an indefensible political situation.
And when you went up there, did you feel it was dangerous?
When I went up there, a really interesting thing happened. I had met a guy in Peterborough in the pea factory, and his name was Paddy Doherty, and we got on really, really well. So I went up to see him, and on the way to his house, I passed by the Lyric Theatre, and I saw forthcoming productions, The Shadow of a Gunman. So I walked in and I said, I see you're doing Shadow of a Gunman here. He said, yeah, yeah. I said, he is cast. I said, no, actually, we're looking for a Tommy Owens. I said, I've played it in Dublin. Really? Would you do an audition? They auditioned me on the spot and offered me the gig.
Yeah.
Because I played it. I was from Dublin. I was 18.
Yeah, yeah.
And there I was in the right place at the right time. And so I joined the Lyric Theatre for two shows. So I spent 6 months in Belfast in 1970, just at the outbreak of the Troubles.
What was that like then?
It was wild. It was wild. It was car bombs going off every night. It was like you really had to watch yourself, you know. It was highly dangerous. But I loved it. I loved living in the war zone. I loved it.
A buzz.
A buzz, you know. Loved it. It was fantastic, you know.
Did you then, would the punk scene have affected you?
By that stage I was kind of married. My punkism was more my teenage years and the theatre stuff that we did.
Right,
that was my that was my kicking against the establishment.
Yeah, yeah.
When you talked about the establishment thing, like, I just did the theatre and got involved in it because of my dad and fell in love with it very quickly and just became completely absorbed in it. I just loved it, loved everything about it. And didn't want to do anything else from the moment I discovered it. I thought, this is all I want to do. Now, I played guitar. I'd gotten guitar lessons. So I was into music. I would have been into the Stones, the Beatles, the whole 60s thing. Jim Morrison and the Doors, you know, the Beach Boys, the whole thing. Loved all that. But the theatre very quickly took over from the music. Although the music has remained a huge part of who I am and my influences and all of that kind of thing. But the theatre just took over. So when we got involved in the Project Arts Centre became an extension of what we had been doing in Seville Place and Sheriff Street with my dad.
Okay.
The project became an extension of that. So the plays tended to be political.
Yeah.
They tended to be socially engaged.
So how did the Project Theatre then start up? It was like...
Well, in 1971, Project had a small little gallery space in Abbey Street, opposite the Abbey Theatre, actually. It was in the bottom of a place called the YMCA Hall. Which is now long since gone. It's now the National Lottery, where that building is.
Okay.
Used to be a Presbyterian hall where choirs sang in competition and stuff like that. And we had a little basement in it. And we had toured our theatre stuff around. And Colm O'Brien, who was the founder of the project, saw us in Waiting for Godot at the Roundwood Drama Festival in 1970.
Yeah.
And just could not believe that a group from the north inner city of Dublin were doing this play. And just, you know, we became friends overnight. You know, he became a huge admirer of Jim and myself, and we became admirer of his. And he said, will you come in and do some theatre stuff in Project Arts Centre in Abbey Street? So in 71, 72, we started theatre. Now, there were other people there. It was Tom Hickey. Subsequently, the Reardons,
Benji,
Lurden's. Chris O'Neill, a guy called Chris O'Neill, since deceased, the producer guy. Do you remember Chris?
Is Chris O'Neill, Aisling O'Neill's dad?
Yeah,
yes,
he is indeed.
Yeah.
Great guy. Yeah, great guy.
He was in the Reardons as well.
Indeed, Alan Devlin.
All right, yeah.
Barry McGovern.
Okay,
there was a whole coterie of people who were starting to do stuff in that little basement. Now, we were doing it, it was a gallery space, so there was paintings on the wall while you were doing the plays. And there'd be war between the painters and ourselves, because they'd be saying, you've moved the paintings and you've damaged the paintings. And so there was war going on in the project. I mean, it just wasn't suitable.
Yeah, yeah.
But we were young Turks, and Colm O'Brien wanted us in there.
Yeah.
And we actually did a one-man Beckett show, Jim wrote it, called Unless It Goes On Beyond the Grave, which Jim wrote, and Vinnie McKay performed, I directed it.
Right.
And we did a season in 72, and we did a play about Artane Industrial School, which caused a furore at the time.
Yeah.
Because we were shown the violence that was being meted out upon these young, unsuspecting kids who were in that institution.
Would Mannix Flynn have been around that?
No, Mannix came later. After 71, 72, I got married very young to Sheila. We're still together. And I kind of started thinking about maybe a career as a journalist or maybe a teacher. And I went back to college. But of course, in college, I got sucked into doing theatre in Dramsock.
Right.
So a lot of my time in college, I was either doing stuff in Dramsock or I was working to try and support the family. So for about 3 years, I didn't really do that much other than the college stuff. But when I finished, I thought, I'm done now with that studying lark. I'm going back to the theatre. And I wrote my first play, started it the day after my exams finished in UCD. I wrote my first play called No Entry. which was about the housing situation in Sean McDermott Street and the North Inner City generally, Fenian Street and that whole thing. So I wrote that play, and Project Art Centre had moved to Essex Street. We got the play on in Essex Street.
Right.
And that Essex led...
Street. Is that in Temple Bar?
Yeah, where
yeah,
it still
where it is now.
And myself and Jim basically took over the theatre in Essex Street in 1975. And then we ran it for the next 6 years. In which time, Manix Flynn turned up.
Yeah.
And I met him and put him in a play and then wrote The Liberty Suit based on him.
Right.
Which became a big hit in the 77 Dublin Theatre Festival. That's actually 40 years this year.
Okay.
In
okay.
October this year. That was a huge hit. And that really, you know. So we were out there, you know, doing stuff about social issues, political issues, stuff relevant to people's lives. And I hope we were entertaining as well. It wasn't just an agitprop thing. We were, you know. We had learned a bit, you know. We weren't clowns, you know.
Right. And how did you write? So you write your first play, do you just, I mean, is it all written, or do you go in and work with actors and then?
Well, we were always collaborative.
Yeah.
Jim and
yeah,
myself.
Yeah.
It was always about, here's a script, but you know, we'll change it.
Right, yeah.
You know, and sometimes an actor might even suggest a scene or, you know, whatever, we'd be all on for that, very open to that whole process of making it up as you go along.
And when you're writing the first draft, for example, have you characters, have you voices in your head?
I mean, you obviously have to have characters and some sort of a scenario. I mean, my first play, No Entry, was based on a couple breaking into a squat in Sean McDermott Street with their young kid and finding a dead body in the bed of an old man. Now, what do they do?
That's an amazing start.
It's a great start. So what are they going to do with this dead body? Yeah. They don't want to lose the flat they've just broken into.
Yeah.
So they ring the ambulance, and the ambulance come and they take the body away. But now they're being investigated by the corporation saying, how did you get in here? How did you get into this house? And he's an ex-Artane boy. Right,
and
in the school.
Oh right, okay.
The fella who's the husband.
Yeah.
And so the story starts to go back to how he got to where he is, because he started life in Artane and you know ended up.
How did he end up looking for a squatter? Yeah.
Exactly. So it's kind of it's a flashback.
Yeah.
You know, and we had a lot of street games in it and children's rhymes and all that kind of stuff. We were really interested in that.
Yeah.
Kind of things. But I learned loads from writing that play. Mm-hmm. And I thought the play on Mannix was brilliant.
Yeah.
I mean, that was like a huge jump up in terms of my style and, you know, I had learned a lot of stuff. And obviously I was, you know, I was robbing from other writers as well, as you do when you're, you know, 21, 22, 23. You think, well, I remember I was in a play and I liked that scene, so I'll use that as a template. So The Liberty Suit became a big hit in 77. And from then on, really, I've never done anything else.
Right, yeah.
That's been my career.
And you're happy. You've always, like, not... Yeah. I mean, were there times when you struggled? Or were there times when you said, why didn't I get...
It's still a struggle.
Yeah.
I made money once in my 40-year career. I had about 5 years where I made serious money. When 44, my memoir came out.
Yeah.
That became a bestseller. And so I had a 3-book deal. So for about 5 years, I was earning serious money.
Yeah.
And that was great. And, you know, for the first time ever, Sheena and myself could, you know, do things without worrying about the bank balance.
Yeah.
We never had that experience before, because it was always, where's the next check coming from?
Yeah.
And after the 5 years, when it was really good, it's back to how it was.
Yeah.
Before. It just comes around. It's like a wheel. You come back to, Jesus, we've no money again.
Yeah.
Jesus, we should have kept that money when we had it. We gave it all away to the kids. What did we do? Why did we give that money away? We should have kept some of that money. You know? But, you know...
You wouldn't swap it.
No, I wouldn't swap it for anything. But, and the money has never been important to me.
No, okay.
And that's, I'm being honest now about this. Mm-hmm. Some people, money is important to them.
Sometimes as you get older, you go... Ooh. You know, I mean, it's not important when you're in your 20s as much.
Look, it's like this. Some of the best experiences I've had in my profession have been when I've been working for little or no money.
Mm.
I mean, I've had a wonderful time on some of the projects I've worked on where there was no money involved.
Yeah.
And sometimes I've worked on projects where there's money in it and it's a pain in the arse.
Mm.
And there's a load of egos and there's a lot of people, you know, I don't want to start naming names, but, you know, like well-known people, you know, who think they're something they're not, and, you know, they make your life a misery and they're ego-driven. And it's just unpleasant, and it's unpleasant to be around, and I don't like it, and I don't care about it. And I always sort of confront that stuff.
Mm.
You know, I come from Sherry Street, so I stand up to bullies, you know. Mm. Bullies don't get away with it when I'm around, because I just don't like bullies. So I tend to stand up right. against that kind of shit.
Yeah.
And, I'm working on a project at the moment called Love in the Wild, set in Ballymun. It's about a recovering junkie, a recovering drug addict, written by a first-time writer called Lisa Walsh from Ballymun. It's one of the most beautiful pieces I've ever worked on. It is fantastic.
Yeah.
I'm having a ball every time. At a rehearsal of it today, it was fantastic.
Yeah.
3 hours of joy, you know.
Yeah.
Working on this material with this new writer and an actor friend of mine, Anto Siri. And I'm having a wonderful time. There's no money in it.
Mm.
I don't care. I don't care.
Yeah.
There's a kind of a vocational thing in our business, you know, where, you know, people gave me their time when I was a young aspiring writer.
Yeah.
There were people in this town who helped me hugely. Alan Simpson being one, the great Alan Simpson,
yeah.
theatre director, would have done the very first production of Waiting for Godot, for example, in 1956 in the Pike Theatre. Did the first production of The Queer Fella, lived near me on Clonliffe Road, was a great theatre director. And I brought him my first play, No Entry, and man, he gave me so much time and encouragement,
yeah.
and read the play and read different drafts of it and suggested things to me. Yeah. But he was just there for me, like a father figure. Now, I hope I've passed that on to some other people that I've helped along the way.
Yeah.
I've tried to help some people along the way, and, you know, again, some people are hugely thankful to you, and, you know, and then there are other people, and, you know, they get a leg up and they, you know,
but they pull the ladder up with them.
Yeah, they pull the ladder up with them and they become other than you thought they were, and that happens too, you know. But
yeah.
I don't forget my roots. I don't forget where this all came from. This all came to heal family hurt. This all came, the theatre thing in our family came as a response to a death.
Wow,
where the theatre became the mechanism for us to try and heal ourselves.
Mm.
And it helped hugely.
Astounding. Because, I mean, you've not gone to a college to learn.
No.
It's come from your actual family and it's come from a tragedy, something that's deep within you.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, no one else is going to.
Yeah,
have that story.
But then when you read of other people's stories, you know, the people I admire, like Samuel Beckett, you know, similar, you know, a similar kind of thing for him, you know, where he's writing about, you know, he's writing about a stabbing where he was nearly killed. He's writing about, you know, working for Joyce and, you know, that famous story about he was working as a kind of a secretary on Finnegan's Wake, you know, because Joyce was going blind and couldn't write it himself. So he would call her out, and Beckett was one of the people who transcribed it. And when he was finished, Beckett didn't know how to say to him, look, you owe me whatever it was, you owe me £32 or whatever it was, and he couldn't find the courage to say to Joyce. And eventually, out for dinner one evening in Paris, he says to Joyce, you know, you owe me for the... He says, yes, I do. Just take my overcoat.
Yeah.
So Beckett put on Joyce's overcoat and walked away from the restaurant. That was his payment.
That was his
payment. Walking around in the master's overcoat, feeling shame. You know, feeling...
For taking the coat.
Well, just how could you refuse the coat, first of all?
Yeah.
But the idea that the master had given you something of his to, as it were, saddle you with, to wear it around your shoulders, to weigh you down, as if it wasn't bad enough that you were already transcribing the great man's thoughts from his head. Now you had to wear his overcoat.
That was a put down.
It was a complete put down in a way.
Yeah,
You know, but Beckett writes brilliantly about that kind of, yeah. those kinds of things and incidences in his life.
Right, yeah.
And things that happen to him, you know. Mm. I, you know, I'm Behan, you know, Behan, whom I love and who's much maligned. And there's lots of people now say he wasn't a great writer. He was a great writer. Mm. He didn't write very much, you know. Mm. He only wrote, you know, one great play, Ungil, The Hostage, one great book, Borstal Boy,
yeah.
and a couple of other things that were lesser.
Mm.
But man, like, I mean, you know, coming from where he came from and what he was doing. And
the drink, you know, took over, did it?
Yeah, but he was on active service in the IRA when he was 13, like, you know. He was living in a house where the parents both fought in 16.
Mm.
I mean, he was hearing them right, left and centre.
Mm-hmm.
He only went to England to try and stop the row at home, to shut the parents up. He couldn't listen to it anymore, you know.
Right.
And in England he discovered that actually he was gay, or at least he liked men as much as he did women.
Yeah.
So all his life then he fought with the demon of
that.
He wanted to be a straight guy in a world where it wasn't very comfortable to be other than that.
Yeah.
So that kind of infuses a lot of his work.
Yeah.
And so I find him a really interesting person from that point of view.
Yeah.
You know, that he was grappling with these issues in his life.
But the character took over, didn't it? The kind of raconteur, drunken Irishman.
He was brilliant, though. He was but a brilliant some TV great personality.
Yeah. In America, they
I mean, he was one of the great... Yeah. He was the guy everybody wanted on their show.
Yeah.
Because he was so good on live television.
Yeah.
He was brilliant. A great storyteller, a great singer.
You told a story about when The Hostage maybe were opened in New York.
Yeah.
Could you tell me that?
In the Core Theatre. Yeah. In February 1960, Brendan went over for the opening of The Hostage and proceeds, of course, to get drunk in the bar next door. And he goes in the middle of the second act, full of guilt, because Ungil, the original play, was in Irish. And it was the most important Irish play written in the 20th century.
Mm.
Easily the most important and the best.
Mm.
You know, it was a landmark play. It gave a standing to Irish language drama that it had never reached before. And Brendan loved Irish and he loved the whole Gaeilge thing and he was a beautiful speaker. So he was feeling guilty that he had, in a way, prostituted himself by turning it into an English musical. So into the theatre he goes, stop the fucking play and do the effing play the way I effing wrote it. But instead of getting a negative reaction, he gets a hugely positive reaction from the audience who cheer him. And Brennan was a showman of nothing else. He jumps up on the stage and he starts acting out the scenes from the play. And they're roaring with laughter.
This is class.
And then he starts singing.
The actors have to just take a backseat here.
And then he does a dance.
Yeah.
And he receives a standing ovation. And now The Hostage becomes the talking point of New York. And everybody is buying tickets, hoping that he'll be there to do the interruption.
Yeah.
And he does it on a nightly basis. Goes into the pub, gets drunk, comes in. Standing ovation, Bean's in the house. Stop the effing play and do the play the way I effing wrote it. Now it's a turn.
Yeah,
except one night he goes in and he does the usual trick. Stop the effing play! Silence. Do the effing play the way we effing wrote it! He's in the wrong theatre. He's gone into the theatre where Private Lives is playing next door.
No way.
Yeah.
That's
he does,
a,
and he brilliant. Doesn't realise it for a second. And all these people in Dickie Bows are looking at this mad Irishman.
Oh, that's class.
And I mean, you couldn't make that up.
No, it's brilliant.
It's just so, it's so perfectly Behan. You know, it's so perfectly Behan.
Yeah. Well, listen, thanks, Peter, for chatting. I would like to talk to you another time maybe about Phil Chevron, because I know you knew him well. So perhaps that'd be another time.
Yeah.
Just
to finish on a lovely Phil Chevron, though, one of my favourite people I ever worked with. Phil came into Project Arts Centre while he was still at school.
Mm.
Wanting to write music for a play that we were doing. And we got involved with him and he was just fantastic from day one. Myself, Jim was writing a version of the Trupany Opera, the Bertolt Brecht play. I was to direct and we got Phil in to do the music. And he wrote wonderful music. It was just after Ghost Town and the whole thing, you know. But I always remember one of the songs he wrote. Something's rotten in the whole of Dublin town. Something's going on that isn't going round. Every touch we try, we only get the bird. Every door we come to, they say mum's the word. Bless the truth to us keeping secrets in. Ta, ta, ta. Bless the truth, we are going deeper in. Did you hear the one about the one, you know, the one I mean, the one that did the thing I mean, with the thing that was obscene?
Jesus.
Imagine writing that when you were 23. Or 22 or whatever.
Yeah, you know, yeah.
It was just like Kurt Vile had come up out of coffin and just continued writing.
Amazing.
He just had the sensibility of German cabaret, obviously, which he got from Aggie Barnell, you know, and that association. And he was able to write the most brilliant songs.
Right, yeah.
For that show that we did, which was a disaster, by the way.
Was it? There you go.
Jim out of control, you know.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, it didn't really work. But there was brilliance in it, genius in it, actually. But that song...
What do you mean, Jim out of control? He's just...
Well, Jim gets out of control. He's terrible, like. He's brilliant. He's great. I love him, but Jim out of control is Jim out of control. It's just...
Well, I don't know what you mean, though. Is it like,
you know, Jim gets ideas into his head what things are about, you know. Mm-hmm. He goes to the juggler and things, and it's misfires, you know. Mm-hmm. For me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I love him to bits, but...
And would you tell him?
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Hard sometimes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. I'll talk to you about the Phil Chevron thing. Yeah. I want to do a live...
Yeah.
Podcast with Pete Holiday involved and stuff like that. So that'll be brilliant. Coming up in September if you're interested, but
definitely.
Yeah. But thanks a lot, Peter.
No problem.
Thank you. Sheridan there, he brought me into his house so I could have a chat with him there, and he's a lovely man, great man. And the next one will be an interview with Tara Flynn. So if you're, I always say this, but if it's your first time subscribing, and even if it isn't, quite frankly, please, you know, get on iTunes and give us 5-star review. Give me a little feedback as well on you could do it on Twitter at JoeRooney1, on Instagram JoeRooneyComedian, and on my website JoeRooneyComedian.com, or on Facebook JoeRooneyComedian. I think any of those formats will do, or you could just come up to me in the street on just me, Joe Rooney, and you could say I like your podcast, or you can give me a thumbs up, or say like to me, or give me 5 stars. But the best thing to do is give me 5 stars, not just in the street, but give them to me on iTunes, and give me a review as well. And I haven't any way of monetarily getting anything out of this podcast so far. I'm working on that, I will find a way where you can actually donate money to me. An actual way online. I mean, you could come up to me in the street and give me money if you want. I don't care. Actually, you could do that. I've no problem with you. If you came up to me and said, I love your podcast, here's €20, I'd no problem with that. And I'd even read your name out, and I'd make sure that you get into the kingdom of heaven when you die. So that's fine. That's, you know. That's it. I'm going to be heading to Chicago to do a couple of gigs in clubs, if I can get a spot on the way back there. I do love Chicago. I've been there 5 days in my whole life, but I think I love it. And I bought a suit in a vintage shop, which I think is probably not even as nice as I thought it was. But I ended up buying it and getting it adjusted and everything in a Mexican tailor's place. There's no way I'm going to wear it here because it's feckin' roasting. And I bought a waistcoat, which of course they call a vest over here. But I said, it's a waistcoat here. So That's it for this week. Thank you again for listening, downloading, subscribing, and all that malarkey. Next week, it's Tara Flynn. Next week, I say, because it'll probably be 2 weeks, because I'm so fucking busy, man. And I forgot to get a cable that I was needed to download this podcast onto my laptop. It's a USB to mini USB. I mean, I have loads of these cables at home, but I forgot to pack one. And just trying to find an electrical shop in a city that you don't know is hard. And it's also probably something that you just don't want to do because you're in a new city. You're going, what, am I going to look at the sites or am I going to go looking for a cable? You probably look for the sites first, so that's what I diddly did. I was going to get the cable, but I just couldn't find the damn play shop. And you know, you don't know where people are going to sell cables in different countries. You probably get them, you know what I mean? You know, maybe in America, we sell those cables in candy stores. No, they don't. Well, anyway, whatever. Okay, so thanks a lot. Okay, talk to you soon. Goodbye. Goodbye from Kansas City, the city of a thousand fountains, blowing water in the air, sprinkling people and their hair as they walk by. So yeah, on the 24th of September in the Workman's Club, I'll be recording a live podcast, a tribute to Phil Chevron of Radiators from Space and the Pogues, with guests Peter Sheridan, Peter Holliday, and Steve Rapid, and one other surprise guest. If you want to get tickets, go to the Dublin Podcast Festival website or tweet me at JoeRooney1. Good evening. I sometimes astound myself when I'm interviewing my regular interviewees on this podcast with what I've learned over the last few years in my ability to get people to reveal a part of them that they seem not to reveal to any other interviewer, to pull apart the curtains of mystery, let me peek through their windows, their back windows, into their very kitchen, and see what is going on in the parts of them that they dare not show to anybody else, and they dare not wish to reveal, but they somehow do. And in this following interview, you may be surprised at what is revealed. I don't mean that in a tabloid manner or in a gossipy way. I think it's an honour to see inside someone's mind, someone's soul, someone's heart, and to share it with you, the listener. Enjoy.